This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Andrea Seabrook in Washington. Neil Conan is away. It's been a wave of cyber attacks, and it seems no business, no public organization is safe. Hackers from anarchic groups called LulzSec and Anonymous have broken into the U.S. Senate servers. They took down the CIA public website yesterday. They've hit the G20, the International Monetary Fund, and Lockheed Martin. These attacks may be relatively benign. The groups style themselves as mischief makers, more interested in showing their power than in compromising sensitive data. But their success shows the Swiss cheese-like consistency of American security and exposes vulnerabilities that could be exploited by state-sponsored hackers focused on international espionage and outright cyber war. If you work in IT or online security, what are you seeing? How serious is this threat? Our number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. With me here in the studio 3A is Jim Lewis. He's the director of senior fellow of Technology and Public Policy Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. A little ham-handed, Jim, but welcome to the show.
Thank you. I do have to get a better title.
What is this LulzSec? It seems to be everywhere. Everyone I know is asking, who are these people? Are they dangerous?
They're probably not dangerous, so that's the good news. But they are very active. They seem to be enjoying themselves, so I'm glad for that. And they're one of several groups we've seen in the last year or so, Anonymous being the other, of what people call hacktivists. Mainly young people who use the internet as the world's largest megaphone to make a political point.
Is the government prepared for attacks like these? Are businesses prepared?
We want to split the attacks into two parts. The things that you see LulzSec and Anonymous doing really aren't that dangerous. And none of the things they did, they're annoying, they're embarrassing, but they aren't damaging. On the other side, you have some very damaging activities, probably carried out by states, by governments. Mm-hmm. And the recent break at IMF, the efforts to break into Lockheed Martin or RSA, those were pros. So you've got hacktivists and you've got professionals. And between the two of them, it certainly has been a busy month.
So the thing that comes to mind that's been the most high-profile sort of espionage or warfare that we've seen is Stuxnet, the one that seriously damaged Iran's nuclear program, broke the cylinders in a nuclear reduction plant. How did that work? And what does it tell us about the future of cyber warfare?
Well, it's interesting because we, CSIS, did a review of how many countries have kind of publicly admitted they're looking at cyber attack for its military potential. And we found 36 countries that will say publicly, yeah, our militaries are thinking about it. And what you saw in Stuxnet is something that right now only a few countries can do, maybe mm-hmm. five or six, which is destroy things using the internet.
Let me break in here and say, sure, for people who don't follow technology, this would be like a doctor or a medical researcher coming up with a human virus that was targeted at one person a world away, and then giving that virus to the person sitting next to them in the lab and waiting for the virus to spread across the population of the world until it hit the one person that it was designed for. Am I right?
It's pretty cool. And someone put a lot of effort into it. And the alternative was probably an airstrike. So when you compare the Stuxnet, not a lot of collateral damage, no deaths, no civilian casualties, no funny pictures on television of burning buildings, with the damage that it did, and it was quite effective, it's really an attractive option for some kinds of activities.
But how much more is there that we aren't seeing here, out here in public?
There's the warfare side, which we know that countries are developing attack techniques. Now, it's worth pointing out that very often these exploit vulnerabilities that once they're used, it's very hard to use them again. So these are one-time weapons, things like Stuxnet. Espionage, a daily occurrence, right? many, many countries engage in it. The U.S. is the primary target, although, of course, we do our own spying. So espionage is something we see every day. For attacks like Stuxnet, I think there's only been two or three since the dawn of the Internet.
Okay. I want to bring in another guest here. This is Kevin Paulson. He's the senior editor at Wired.com. He's the author of Kingpin, How One Hacker Took Over the Billion-Dollar Cybercrime Underground, which came out in February, and he joins us by Skype. Kevin Paulson, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Kevin, you're a former hacker and now a senior editor at Wired, as we said. You've covered these attacks also by hacktivist groups. Can you tell us how they do this and what kind of threat do they really pose for national security?
So far, there's no reason to think that they pose a threat to national security, at least not when you talk about the hacktivist groups and LulzSec and Anonymous and those types. The attacks have not been... have not shown the kind of patience that that we've seen in the presumed state-sponsored attacks, like the attacks on Lockheed Martin or RSA. Instead, they're kind of quick hits. They pull pranks. A lot of them are technologically unsophisticated, and it looks like in a lot of cases they're going for targets of opportunity instead of picking a target and then figuring how to get into it.
Well, how serious is the threat to people like me? I mean, you know, like those of us who are normal citizens, what I wonder is my electric grid, nuclear power plants that may be near me, public utilities. Kevin Paulson, what do you think?
I think the threat to the power grid and to other critical infrastructures is grossly overstated. We've been hearing now for well over a decade, really almost 20 years, that computer hackers are going to be causing power outages, and so far there's no confirmed case of that happening. So it's not anything new. And a lot of these sectors are actually more secure now than they used to be. They've made some improvements. So there are still significant vulnerabilities, but I don't expect that we're going to see the lights go out tomorrow as a result of a computer attack. And if we did see attacks of that nature, it would not be coming from hacktivists, and it would not be coming from people like LulzSec, who are, like I said, going after relatively easy targets.
Well, let's set those so-called hacktivists aside for a second. And let me ask you, Jim Lewis, for your view on how vulnerable the infrastructure of the United States might be if a cyber war soldier, I guess you could say, can attack one nuclear plant in Iran. Is it realistic to think they could attack electric grids and these sorts of things? Or as Kevin Paulson says, is that overreacting?
Well, I don't think we're going to see a cyber war per se, because it's just not worth it. I mean, they're fun, but they're not something you're not going to launch a cyber attack just because you're in a bad mood. But when you think of it as part of a larger portfolio of weapons that some of our opponents have, we have, if we get into a shooting match with places like China or Russia, they will have the option of going after our electrical grid. Now, how successful they would be, we don't know. But I frankly think they would probably be able to pull this off if they wanted to. But then you have to think of it as, do the Russians and the Chinese want to get into a war with the U.S.? And right now the answer is no. When more people get the capability, when the Iranians or the North Koreans or groups like Al-Qaeda get the capability, and hopefully we're some years away from that, then it might change. But right now, it's like missiles. They have them, they could use them, but they're not going to unless we get into a fight.
You know, this whole world of espionage and the preparing or the possibility of cyber war makes me think of the current relationship the United States has with Pakistan. It's sort of on the surface, of course, yes, of course we wouldn't attack the United States. But under the surface, what's out there? What's actually propagating across the net that could be harmful?
Well, you've got some major espionage programs that have been going on for more than a decade. And one senior U.S. official described this period to me as the golden age of signals intelligence. And unfortunately, we're good at it, but so are the Russians and the Chinese and a couple others, to be frank. So what we're seeing is long-standing programs by at least those two countries to acquire technology, confidential business information from the United States. And because our private sector defenses are so pathetic, they've had a relatively high degree of success. To be fair, they've had a high degree of success against the government as well, but at least on the defense side, there's been a little more action in tightening things up.
Kevin Paulson, I was interested to see in the Wall Street Journal a op-ed from Richard Clark. Of course, he worked for three presidents, the latest one being George W. Bush. And he was critical of the Bush administration for its stance in counterterrorism before 9/11. The subtitle of his op-ed was, "If we discovered Chinese explosives laid throughout our national electrical system, we'd consider it an act of war. China's digital bombs pose as grave a threat." It sounds like you're saying overblowing the threat here, but the capability sure seems to be there.
Well, Richard Clark has been saying things like that for a while. The reports of Chinese cyber bombs littered throughout our electrical grids have never really been substantiated either. What we've seen are anonymously sourced stories coming from intelligence agencies, but no cooperation from within the power industry. We haven't seen like the people that actually have their hands on this equipment coming out and saying, yes, we found logic bombs planted in the control systems. I think one lesson.
Can you just say, can I stop you 1 second? What is a logic bomb?
I guess I shouldn't have said that. A logic bomb is software that's designed to lie in place and then to virtually explode at some point and damage the system that it's on. So that's what what the stories have been about software being found somewhere in the electrical grid in the U.S., that we've seen software that at a particular point can be triggered to cause damage to control systems and theoretically cause a blackout. But then we've been seeing stories like this, like I said, for 20 years now, and they never actually bear out. They're never substantiated. In the meantime, the people that are actually in charge of cybersecurity on the grid aren't reporting things like this, at least not among themselves and in public. Hmm. You were talking about Stuxnet. I think there's one thing that's worth looking at there, which is this was a phenomenally successful piece of malicious software. Mm-hmm. It actually, as Jim pointed out, it actually caused physical damage, and it was brilliantly targeted and expertly written. It still did a tiny fraction of what a physical attack would have done on that plant.
Okay.
It's nothing at all like an airstrike.
Kevin Paulson, we'll talk more about the threat from cyber attacks when we get back. If you work in IT, what are you seeing? How serious is the threat? 800-989-8255, or the email address is talk@npr.org. I'm Andrea Seabrook. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Andrea Seabrook in Washington. We're talking about cyber attacks and cyber war and whether or not we're prepared for the threat. We're not talking about stolen credit cards. It's hackers who break into Senate computers and steal secret documents from government contractors and computer worms that target nuclear processing equipment in Iran. If you work in IT or online security, what are you seeing? How serious is this threat? Our number is 800-989-8255. The email address is talk@npr.org. And you can join the conversation at our website. Go to npr.org and click on Talk of the Nation. Right now I'm talking with Jim Lewis. He directs the Technology and Public Policy Program at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. And Kevin Paulson, he's a former hacker and now a senior editor at Wired.com. Jim Lewis, I want to come to you for a quick point. We were talking just before the break about Stuxnet, that computer worm that did damage to an Iranian nuclear plant of some kind that was bomb-making, assumingly, plant. Tell me what you were saying just during the break.
Kevin's right in that the effect of a cyber weapon will never be as damaging as a kinetic weapon. But in this case, it was more precise. And so talking to people who were thinking about what an airstrike would look like, it would have been very hard, and Stuxnet was a lot easier. So this is where we're getting into the trade-offs military commanders will think about. Easy, but maybe less damaging. Hard, a little more physical effect.
Okay. Kevin Paulson, Jim Lewis, I want you both to hang on. We've got some callers that are all queued up and ready to ask questions of you. Let's start with Ira. He's in Reno, Nevada. Hi, Ira. You're on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you very much, and thank you, Mr. Lewis and Mr. Paulson, for being on the show today. I work in information and digital forensics, and I've noticed in the last 6 months or so, with all of the publicity around these attacks, not that the attacks are really anything new, but the publicity around them certainly is, a small amount of increase in interest by some non-technical managers in just saying, you know, are we vulnerable, we being the company or the organization, are we vulnerable to these attacks? But only a very small increase in that. And yet, in contrast that, there actually was an attack by a hacktivist group against a political organization in New Zealand, where they released the members of the organization. They broke in probably through a SQL injection attack, I think, to get the member list and publicize that. And one of my clients works in a political organization. I sent an email to the executive director pointing to this news story and say, hey, you know, we've talked before about you having vulnerabilities to these kinds of issues, and you may want to revisit this. Please, you know, please give me a call. And I've heard nothing. So my question is, do you think that the publicity around these attacks will actually have a substantial increase or impact on non-technical managers and their interest in actually addressing information security, or will we just continue, or will we just slide back to the shrug your shoulders, hey, our organization is not the bank, it's not the Defense Department, so we really don't need to worry about it?
Jim Lewis.
I call it the conversion experience. People get religion after they've been hacked, and I've just seen that over and over again. I will say in the last couple months, because of these incidents, you're beginning to see a change, and that change relates to dollars. Companies look at Sony, they look at the $170 million it lost, and they say, hey, wait, that's real money. Maybe I need to do something. So I agree with you, but we're beginning to see the ice break.
Thanks for your call, Ira. Let me put a question to Kevin Polson here. I hear your skepticism, and I recognize as a journalist as well that there are a lot of companies out there ready to make a lot of money off of the threat of cybersecurity. And so it's in their best interest to pump up the threat here. But at the same time, just as our caller Ira was just saying, if information is itself a weapon in a political universe, how vulnerable might we be?
Well, there I'm completely on Jim's side. I think we're definitely seeing an enormous amount of cyber espionage. This is completely different from warfare. This isn't going to kill anybody. It's clear that China and other countries and undoubtedly the U.S. have very ambitious cyber espionage programs, and we've seen evidence of it just in recent months with these Gmail attacks and Lockheed Martin and RSA.
It's everywhere. It's Sony. It's the PlayStation Network. It's Gmail. I mean, my gosh, it's not just the Senate public website anymore.
But you're talking about different actors with different motives, right? So Sony was almost certainly the hacktivist group Anonymous trying to cause problems for Sony.
Even if it is a hacktivist versus espionage, it shows the vulnerability, right? So does it matter?
Yes. Yeah, the vulnerability is there. And what's interesting is that for the better part of a decade, the targets of the sophisticated hackers have been limited to organizations that had something of value in the computer underground. So they were banks, and they were merchants that processed credit card numbers, and what was being stolen was identity information and credit card information. Now that we're seeing a hacktivist movement out there that's growing and that's picking targets for purely political reasons, they're finding a lot of soft targets. They're finding organizations that have never had cause to be secure because they've never been targeted before. And that's where we're gonna start seeing a bloodbath, I think.
I'm going to go to another caller. We have Joe in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hi, Joe. You're on Talk of the Nation.
Hi. I'm actually just calling, making a statement, reaffirming what your guest had just stated. The amount and level of attacks of any company with an open-facing computer network of any sort, whether it's a VPN or a website they're hosting from their own location, I've seen here at customers' locations multiple attempts by networks, whether they're based in China or whatnot. They're usually used through a proxy, but they're constant attempts for maybe an hour at a time. You'll see maybe three attempts to log in per second consistently for hours at a time, and
wow.
they break off and move on to another location. But It's something we see even at small companies here in my area, which makes me concerned for any types of larger companies. If they're hosting the same type of security, they're extremely vulnerable. I mean, these people are relentless in their attempts to get even minor amounts of information.
Thank you, Joe, for your call. It's sort of sobering, Jim Lewis, isn't it? I mean, why aren't companies, people, the government more protected, secure, ready for this?
Well, I think the government's gotten religion, and that's because they had some major disasters or problems in 2008, 2007, intelligence-related, you know, loss of information.
Like what?
Well, in 2007, defense, state, NASA, energy, commerce, I'm probably leaving somebody out, all were broken into. In 2008.
Could you just name that list one more time?
Defense, state, commerce. Who did I leave? Oh, NASA. Oh, energy, right. So it was a good haul. And then in 2008, you had both the McCain and Obama campaigns were hacked, and their contributors' lists were exfiltrated. In 2008, you had Central Command penetrated by a foreign intelligence agency. It's classified network penetrated by a foreign intelligence agency.
Wow.
So the government's gotten religion. Companies, I think, I talked to one oil company. They have a fabulous defensive system in place. Why do they have that system in place? Because a couple years ago, they lost a huge amount of exploration data, and it cost them millions of dollars.
Jim Lewis, director and senior fellow of the of Technology and Public Policy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I want to turn now to Kevin Mitnick. He himself was once a hacker. He is a well-known former hacker, now working for the other side, White Hat, as a security consultant. His book, Ghost in the Wires, My Adventures as the World's Most Wanted Hacker, comes out in August. He joins us from member station KNPR in Las Vegas. Welcome to the program, Kevin Mitnick.
Hey, thank you for having me on.
Do you think it is appropriate to separate Anonymous and Lulzsec and these sort of hacktivists from the more state-sponsored or criminal elements on the internet if the vulnerabilities are all the same?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I think these groups like Lulzsec, for example, when they did a denial-of-service attack against the CIA's website, I mean, that's a real simple attack. I mean, I remember I have kind of a flashback of this. I think he was 12 or 13 years old. This kid in Canada named Mafia Boy, mm-hmm. who attacked CNN, Yahoo, eBay, and other big brands back in 2000, precisely doing the same thing. So this is not sophisticated. I think Kevin Polson brought this up earlier. And then you have the attackers that, as he mentioned, going after RSA and then leveraging the information stolen from RSA against targets like Lockheed Martin, Northrop Grumman, and L3. I mean, those are quite sophisticated attacks.
Huh. Interesting. What drives these attacks? I mean, we've heard about the espionage. We've talked some about the cyber warfare. Is it talk to me for a second about the hacktivists, because it seems like your career was more along those lines. Am I correct?
No, my hacking career is basically for the pursuit of knowledge. I had a real passion for technology, and I wanted to learn everything there was about it. And I kind of started off, you know, as what they call a phone freak, which was like the predecessor to hacking. It was kind of exploring the phone system using the same methods. And adventure. It was more of adventure and fun and a challenge. And those were the primary drivers for me. The hacktivists, you know, in this case, like Lulzsec, it looks like they definitely love the media attention because they have, you know, lots of Twitter followers. They've dedicated a website. And it seems to be more than hacktivism with them because, you know, initially their targets like Sony, I kind of thought, well, maybe they're upset that they went after this other guy named George Hotz, who found a vulnerability in the PlayStation 3 and exposed it, and mm-hmm. Sony sued him. So then they started attacking just random targets like gaming companies and all this sort of thing. So then I started thinking, well, maybe it's more of the attention seeking that they're really enjoying. I mean, shows like this on NPR, we're talking about them. So they're probably eating it up alive. And it's, you know, it's like a vicious cycle. It just drives them to do more because the more they do, the more media attention they're getting.
Well, let's turn to something else now. No, I'm just joking. Let me ask you, though, Kevin Mitnick, if these hacktivists, I mean, even the term hacktivist suggests that they are activists of some kind for something. To me, it sounds like they're just anarchists. They just, they want to show how much they can control things.
They don't like something. Like, for example, they didn't like the idea that hacking could be considered in some cases an act of war. And they got pissed off about it, so they went after an FBI partner organization called InfraGuard and got into their website and exposed passwords of the users and just went after them. I mean, I think just recently they set up a telephone number where people can call into to make requests for targets for them to hack, and they were getting so much traffic, so many phone calls, that they decided just to reroute that traffic to an FBI office, apparently. This is what I saw on Twitter. I don't know if it's, you know, I didn't confirm it to be true. And then just basically, you know, the FBI office in, you know, Detroit or something is just overindulged with, you know, thousands of telephone calls, you know, and just doing, you know, stuff like this. It kind of makes me think maybe these are 20-year-old kids. You know, I think, you know, they're probably in the UK and they're probably on school break or something and doing this type of stuff. I don't think they're terribly sophisticated. The type of attacks they're doing, denial of service, they're finding SQL injection vulnerabilities. And SQL injection is like SQL is like a database language that is used to communicate with databases like primarily used like in web applications that they're mm-hmm. exploiting out there, and they're able to find ways that they could inject their own instructions into these programs. So when these programs run, it does something unattended, and they're able to do things like get access to information that they shouldn't, or mm-hmm. they're able to even get access to the server itself. And this is like the number one vulnerability out there on the web is SQL injection. They seem to be, you know, attacking a lot of sites using this technique. So it's not terribly sophisticated like the RSA hack that recently happened.
Well, Kevin McNick, well, I have you just a couple seconds more. Can you give us any insight, being a former hacker yourself, as to how they might be organized and how they could be stopped or roadblocks being put on them, or are we just at their whim? Is it just cat and mouse?
Well, I don't know. They're sophisticated. They obviously feel very, quite invincible with their ability to remain anonymous. I mean, they could be using a prepaid credit card and going out and buying a cell phone with a data plan and then tethering to that and always on the move to make it difficult. They could be doing what Max Butler, who Kevin Polson wrote about in his book, Kingpin, about using, you know, Wi-Fi networks of neighbors and, you know, using directional antennas. They could be – so they obviously feel invincible. I don't know how well they're covering their tracks, but obviously they feel extremely comfortable, else they wouldn't be going public like this.
Kevin Mitnick is a former hacker, now a security consultant. His book, Ghost in the Wires, My Adventures as the World's Most Wanted Hacker, is out in August. He joins us from member station KNPR in Las Vegas, Nevada. Thank you, Kevin.
Hey, thank you.
Let me turn back now to you, Jim Lewis. What did you think of what he was saying? And can you give us any hint as to what the future might look like for those of us who are normal Americans living normal lives and don't know about database attacks and all that kind of stuff?
Well, I got to talk to some of these anonymous folks, anonymously, of course. And they had a sense, a couple of them made a comparison that what they were doing was like the Freedom Riders in Selma, which was, you know, really struck me as a bit overstated. But they have the sense that they are engaged in a political activity. And I think Kevin was right. They're also having a lot of fun out of it. What's going to happen, though, is that we're adjusting. And 5 years from now, you won't see things like this. What you will see might be very different, but in some ways Anonymous and LulzSec are encouraging us to come up with solutions to this kind of very basic sort of attack.
Kevin Polson?
I got to disagree with Jim there. I think Anonymous is going to be around 5 years from now. LulzSec probably not, but we're going to see we're going to see these kinds of attacks continue because they're going for the low hanging fruit. They're going for the easy targets, and they're always going to be easy targets. And frankly, what Anonymous and LulzSec is doing is really nothing different than we haven't seen hackers doing for decades. And it's never been stopped, and it's never gone away. So it's always going to be a part of our day to day lives.
I have a couple of tweets and an email that have come in, and they both point to the fact that these attacks are just constant. So I appreciate both of you coming on. Kevin Paulson is the senior editor at Wired and author of Kingpin, How One Hacker Took Over the $1 Billion Cybercrime Underground. And Jim Lewis is at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Thanks both of you for joining us. Coming
Thank
up,
you.
The secrets to writing a hit song. Evan Bogart's done it for Beyonce, Rihanna, and Enrique Iglesias. I'm Andrea Seabrook. This is Talk of the Nation from NPR News.